Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave Krueger. I am happy you're here, and I'm eager to collaborate with you and looking forward to our time together. You probably saw an email that I sent out this afternoon asking a couple of questions of you, and some of you have responded back, and I appreciate that very much. One question is, if we were to sit down face-to-face, what would you most like to ask me about this whole subject about change and transitions? And secondly, if you were to walk away from this seminar series saying this is one of the best you've ever attended, what would you walk away with? And your responses will help me in shaping some of the content and some of the illustrations of the content. I have some things in mind, as you see from the outline and the work pages and exercises that I had for you to download. I hope you've downloaded the outline, because it'll make it a lot easier in listening, so you can just listen to a lot of things and not write down things and have a chance to look at the work pages. But I'm eager to hear from you now, your responses right now, for those of you who haven't sent an email. What kind of things would you most like us to be sure and address during this time together about coaching change and transition? If you'd say your name and where you're from and what your question is, I'm eager to hear from you. And I take your responses very seriously.
Hi, Dave. This is Jody. I'm in Richmond, Virginia.
Welcome. Hey.
Hey, Dave. The question I have is, how does fear play into transitioning from a
Okay, let me interrupt you. Could I get a management of the background noise? Anybody who's not talking, do a mute *6, because there's sounds that your mic or your receiver picks up that you're probably not aware of. And remember to unmute when you're ready to talk *6 again. So, Jody, would you take that from the top again, please?
Sure. Just wanted to know, how does fear play into transitioning from a physiological and a psychological point of view? So the fear factor in transitioning really really is interesting to me. And I want to come away with a simple understanding of what roadblocks people most have about the process of transitioning.
Okay. All right, great. One of the things that we're going to talk about is how a very understandable response to change and to transition is to have certain anxiety and trepidation. Think about every experience that you've had of huge significance, such as when you made a transition into coaching. The uncertainty, the trepidation, the anxiety was an indication that you were on the cusp of something new and different, but it didn't feel good at the time because your mind and your brain both are addressing aspects of change, of unpredictability. And as you probably came to do, to reframe that as this change in anxiety is different from a model of the past. In an old model, fear equals danger, better head for cover. In this new model, this is an indication, a signpost of change. This is an affirmation of moving ahead. So by simply reframing it, it means you tolerate it and stay with it longer and stronger until it becomes something other than fear. So the mindset, the framework you place around something and the meaning you attach to it makes the difference in terms of how we interpret and how we experience that. So that's why, and we're going to come back to this, when we work with someone and help them address change, one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful force of the human psyche is our identity. And if someone just changes without changing their identity, if they change a piece of behavior without changing their identity, they're going to revert back to their core identity and give up the change. That's why in coaching we have to help someone evolve the model of who and what they are, of their identity, along with the changes they're making, so that it can be changes that last, changes that are permanent. And we'll talk more about how to do that. So that's a good question, and I've got that along with the others that others of you have sent. So thank you, Jody, and I hope
sure.
I heard that correctly in terms of the thrust that you were giving it in the direction.
Yes.
Super. Other thoughts or other questions?
Dave, this is This is John in Longmont, Colorado.
Welcome. Hey.
And I have, I guess, a question that's very similar to hers. My question was, how can I help coach around transition that takes away the fear?
Okay.
Is that exactly
what we're going to talk about. That's a great question.
Okay. Okay.
And remember this, that nothing that any of us has ever done that's really important does not begin with some anxiety and uncertainty.
Yeah, some anxiety, yeah.
We do not know how it's going to turn out. And that means that we are very vulnerable to staying in our status quo, in the zone of familiarity, and not trying the change and transition. But I think it's always important to distinguish these two things, dosing and timing and titrating of something versus avoidance. And that's important to remember in working with clients, the procrastination versus the addressing something dosed and timed and titrated in the way that's most optimal for them. So great question. Got that down.
Okay.
Who else?
Hi, my name is Leslie. I'm calling from Narragansett, Rhode Island.
Super. Okay, go ahead.
I am looking to find out how to be able to help people with transitions when they have a blank slate in front of them and help them design the next steps.
Okay, can you give an example of that, Leslie?
Well, I have a couple clients that are going through empty nesting.
Okay.
And they don't know what to do next. They're just unsure because they've been so used to just taking care of the kids, and you know that that's their daily activity is taking care of the kids. And all of a sudden, now they can have time for themselves, and then they don't know what to do with themselves. So it's trying to help them find out their identity and what they like to do, and it is a big transition for most people.
That is, and that's a huge application of this when there's not a pre-designed map that someone's or plan that someone steps into. They're having to make it up step by step as they go through it. So yeah, great point. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Who else?
Hi, David. This is Catherine in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Welcome. Hey.
Hi. How soon can one prepare our clients to get us an inkling at least of the richness of what can come out of that transition?
I think it's a good place to begin with and revisit throughout, because they are going to have visions and ideals of what they want to get to. And remember this, though, someone can only imagine from within their own system. So that's why this also is a process, because revisiting this idea and where somebody ideally wants to get to is going to evolve, because their system is going to expand. And their view of possibilities, of the richness of where they want to get to is going to evolve and expand, and they're going to be at a place that they never could have quite imagined as you began to work with them for a while. So it's a process. It's a continuing engagement, just like the example I gave of helping someone revise the model of who they are as they're going through change. This is another aspect of that model. Because their own needs, their own ideals, and you'll see those two exercises at the back of the outline in the work pages. Those are the two exercises that I do with almost every client, because getting their top three needs and their top three ideals help me know more of what their bedrock identity is, because that's something that is very useful to have. I put it inside their folder. So that I'll have reference to that, so that when their needs and ideals are aligned with strategies and goals, it's like all of them is going in the same direction. So having reference to that and keeping that question in mind and collaborating about that is something that will be much of the text of the coaching, and I think a real powerful component of it. But we'll talk about that, and let's revisit that question at different points along our journey here and looking at an overview of some of the instances. Anything else real quick, just one more before we move into the material, because I want to save some time for discussion at the end too. Anyone else?
Hi, Dave. Dr. Is there somebody else?
Go ahead, Sylvia, please.
This is Lee in Washington, D.C., and I want to work with older people, and I guess I want to know the extent to which that transitions that are affected by aging, which is not going to go backwards or change, should be handled.
Okay. And I'm also going to talk some in the last seminar about wellness and the whole concept of that along with transition. So that's a good question. Thank you very much, Lee. And Sylvia, you had a question or a comment? No? I've been wrong before. Okay. Okay. I'm going to put us on lecture mode. So that you don't have to worry about the mute and the noise, and then we'll come back at the end for discussion and questions. So anything you want to comment on or ask, just. Thanks again for all of your input and your ongoing input. I welcome that. I value it very much, and it does make a difference. I want to talk in our first seminar about the dynamics of change and transition. And let's start with what's your story. When we hear someone, and when we want to know who, when someone, we want to know them to know who we are, we share stories of our childhoods, our families, what's important to us. When we know people well, we know their stories, what's important, what shaped and molded them, the trials and turning points that have tested them. Our own story is a significant organizer of our experiences, a continuity of where we've been, where we are now, where we'll go. So stories orient, define, and guide us. A good story is never more necessary than at a time of change and transition, a time that's unsettling, confusing, uncertain, insecure. There's also a first component of the work pages that has to do with looking at the story of transition. The ability to craft a good story at this crucial time is significant, I think, to the success of everything that will follow. We learn through stories. We use stories to understand, to make sense of things, and to remember. A good story bridges past and present to make sense of where we are and the uncertain future. So let's look first, then, in this evolving story, at the dynamics of change. The change is the event, the situation. You move to a new city, divorce, retire, have a significant loss, take a job, lose an old one, or change careers. As we focus on change, we focus on the rituals of change, the work tools, the strategic goals. First, the idea of change will create anticipation. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, trepidation, even anxiety. Next, if you continue rather than return to your comfort zone, expansion into the new experience. Then, finally, mastery. Now, two additional aspects of experiencing change can seem paradoxical. One is, every step forward means relinquishing a past position. Someone must mourn. They must say goodbye emotionally as well as practically to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story, even one that doesn't work that well. This is a process. It's a developmental step. It's not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it and change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend, to give up a habit or a pattern of behavior or even a hope that by getting the old story just right or doing it better is going to make it work. Secondly, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. This carefully crafted old story, even with some aspects of identity attached, is replaced by something better. Now, I see at least six components in this dynamic of change. Now, these are not headlines. These are not things that you're going to see, signs that you can label from your clients. But These are just for your reflection to think about as internal conceptual markers. The myth that there's a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. The disappointment that nothing really is perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. How many times have you heard somebody say, this isn't fair? Well, in adulthood, it's not going to be fair because there's not an ultimate arbiter of fairness in adulthood. The development, the recognition that no one's going to take care of it for you, that you're an adult now, you stand alone. The growth to take the next best action. And the consolidation, the happy, sad experience resulting. Happy about the effectiveness of not constructing an obstacle to move ahead, and sad about mourning an old story. And these two are mixed together, sometimes in a confusing way. Every transition begins with an ending, a change event, and we have to let go of the old before we can begin the new. Every beginning ends something. And as Agnes Allen, American writer, says, almost anything is easier to get into than out of. Changing to a better job or career may ironically cause a similar grief and confusion as the sad end of an important relationship in the past. The reason it's important to recognize this is that some of the feelings you experience today may have nothing to do with the present ending, but come from the resonance with similar positions in the past or situations in the past. Letting go is difficult. Herodotus, Greek historian, the 5th century BC, said this, diseases always attack men when they're exposed to change. And that includes even when we look forward to a change and anticipate it eagerly. Some of us still hold on to what we used to be, what we wonder about whether the change was a good or bad idea. We are defined and define ourselves by our roles and relationships, those we like as well as ones we don't. And letting go is an ambiguous experience. New skills are needed for negotiating passage, separating the old from the new. The characteristic ways of coping with endings need to be understood because every person, each person, has his or her own style of ending and new beginning. People tend to respond to endings in their own typical way, to have characteristic reactions to ending and a similar mental state and mood. I want to give you some examples because this is a kind of a way of characterizing some of the major different ways that and styles that people have. Four of the most common styles of ending. One, abrupt. This is designed to deny the impact and the meaning of change. Two, slow and gradual, so that it's difficult to see that anything really important is happening. Three, external focus. Some people learn to cultivate a subtle way of covertly inviting people to act upon them when change is in the air. And four, active or passive, proactive or reactive, the position you take vis-a-vis the change. Some people work to establish blamelessness in regard to endings. Well, she just walked out on me. No warning, no nothing. She just left me. It's like someone who shouts, I didn't do it, when the police arrive. So it calls attention to himself and makes everybody suspicious. Now, how you approach change comes from the style you've developed for dealing with endings. And this is consistent. That style is likely to reflect early experiences as well as later influence and be consistent over time and situations. Typically, someone repeats a behavior pattern as with other important losses. One person feels the grief and anxiety for the entire group. Another comforts the mourner. Another takes over the routine responsibility. And another assumes control for the situation. And this is often the way it happened in a family of origin. Although it's advantageous to understand your own style of endings, a part of you will resist that understanding with a passion. Now, we're not talking about just the big endings here. Divorce, career transition, job loss, children leaving for college, retirement. even the small endings have their own personality that are usually consistent with the big endings. Think about, for example, how you tend to act at the end of an evening at a friend's house or after a night on the town. Do you drag things out by starting new activities and conversations when others seem to be ready to leave? Do you suddenly say that it was a nice evening and abruptly dash out? Did you say goodbye to everyone or leave ahead of the plan so you could just avoid the goodbyes? Notice how the small and large endings can be the same, leaving a job or moving from a neighborhood, as well as leaving a dinner with friends. The person who leaves early and the one who stays late both avoid endings in their own way, as well as the discomfort of the disruption. A dasher and a lingerer share the same dynamic, actually. Two sides of the same coin. There are things we don't want to happen, but have to accept. Things we don't want to know, but have to learn. People we can't live without, but have to let go. It's the ending that makes the beginning possible. So here are some principles of letting go. And there are 10 and counting. 1, accept the reality as well as the importance of the subjective losses. In other words, the meaning of the loss itself. 2, acknowledge the loss openly. 3, accept and expect overreaction. Overreaction comes because of the emotional impact of loss as well as past experiences with loss. Whenever we have one loss, it resonates emotionally with all the other losses, so we're really dealing with more than just the loss in the immediate foreground. 4, expect and accept the process of grief and each of its 5 stages: anger, bargaining, anxiety, sadness, then disorientation and confusion before you get to acceptance. 5, compensate for the losses. Ask yourself, what can I give back to balance what's been taken away or lost? Learn as much as possible about the loss in order to benefit from it. 6, define what's over and what isn't over. That's hard to do sometimes when you're right in the middle of it, but it's exquisitely important. 7, mark the endings. Rather than just talking about the endings, create actions or activities that dramatize them. When Rene McPherson took over the leadership of Dana Corporation, he saw that operations were choked by a culture of rules that nobody could really remember. In a management meeting, he piled all the company manuals on a table. They formed a stack almost 2 feet tall. Then he pushed them to the floor and held up a single piece of paper on which the corporate principles were typed. He said, "These are our new rules." Dramatic, powerful beginning for him. 8, treat the past with respect. 9, take a piece of the old story with you. 10, endings ensure the continuity of what really matters. And the past, the good old days, will be idealized at times and denigrated at times. The changes anyone experiences are different than anything they've ever experienced before. The transition process by which people get through change is a system that's well mapped, but for the individual, it's a first-time experience. So let's now look at the dynamics of transition as opposed to change. The change event is the snapshot. The change process is the wide-angle view. The transition is the time-lapse photograph. The transition is the process, the internal story of change, a shift in orientation, even of self-definition. Transition is awareness of the seasonal cycles while attending to the daily weather. As you respond to change and embrace transition, you let go of the old story, the outlived chapter, and evolve into your new story. You transform a new identity to internalize the changes, to sustain and enhance them. The transition story, provides the coherence that will reassure in the present and will foreshadow the future. The person you were yesterday is the person you are today and the person you will be tomorrow, only more so. Yet, seemingly paradoxically, old stories need to be mourned, and along with them, the self left behind. You also have your own characteristic way of a new beginning, just as with endings. Change and renewal seem to involve new relationships, but they can also involve new places or projects. For some, it begins with a new state of mind, a new feeling, a self-image, or a goal. Sometimes, the beginning results from careful and conscious effort. But for many people, important new beginnings have a kind of mysterious and sometimes accidental quality to them. Although we think we take charge of our lives and plan carefully to start again after an ending, some of the most important beginnings take place in the unfocused darkness outside our awareness. Let me give you an example. 2 years after my divorce, I was at an author's conference in Austin. I was planning to leave Saturday after the last conference meeting. I had just enough time to drive to my ranch between Austin and Houston to catch the sunset. It's something I love to do on the weekends. In fact, one of the measures of the quality of my life is the number of sunsets I'm at the ranch, and it's usually on the weekends, on the porch with a cigar and a single malt scotch, watching the sunset over the lake and trees. But I decided for some unknown reason to stay at that author's conference for the social hour. It was a wine and cheese event. Nothing, by the way, to compare to any single malt scotch. Never mind the cigar and the sunset. There I met my future wife. 2 years later, we would marry on the porch I didn't get to that evening for sunset, at sunset with her children and mine attending. That was 9 years ago. In fact, it's her greeting you heard when you signed off at the beginning of the seminar. Without a transition, change simply rearranges the furniture. People imagine that they can prepare for retirement by making specific changes, such as adequate financial preparations, a place to live, and developing new interests. Yet, the challenge is the transition, and change only prepares you for the transition. People have to let go of the outlived chapters of their life story and find new ones or create new ones to replace them. Are the outlived chapters of a business story to create a new one. At times, rituals and celebrations further the process of transition as well as serve as markers. Every lifetime has its own unique rhythm, and the personal developmental steps for both change and transition deserve attention. Transition, again, is a process. It takes time. No matter how many people you put on the job, it still takes 9 months to make a baby. Three components of transition. First, there's an ending. Secondly, there's a neutral zone, an important directionless time in between filled with mourning, with work, and with getting ready. And thirdly, then you finish with a new beginning. So let's look at these three components in some more detail, because I think the awareness of these stages of transition are going to help you in a huge way with your coaching as you mentor, coach, and guide your clients through their own journey and their own process. One, the ending. Every transition begins with an ending. Even though it sounds backwards, endings always come first, willingly or unwillingly, an ending. The first task is to let go. Whether at the individual or the organizational level, the transactions always start with ending. To start doing things a new way, you have to end the way you're doing them now. The most common mistake is to add a new pattern to the ones already existing. And that's also, by the way, the most common mistake in looking at helping someone change is simply to add a new pattern to the ones already existing. The impact of the transition doesn't necessarily bear a direct relationship to the importance of the change that triggered it. And now this is important because emotionally it doesn't quite make sense. One person can be brought to an abrupt standstill by a divorce or job loss while another person takes it in stride. Someone else may come to terms with a debilitating illness yet be demolished by the loss of a pet. Here's one dramatic way to mark an ending of a story. Spanish explorer Hernando Cortes came ashore with his men at Veracruz, and he knew that his men were extremely reluctant about the exploration ahead and were frightened because they knew the danger. Some had even called it hopeless. Faced with a continent full of unknown adversaries, each person in his party was ambivalent about moving ahead or turning back. Cortes burned the ships. Here are some components of the ending process. There are essentially five aspects of an ending experience. And I want to just mention each and kind of characterize them because I think you're going to see them in various clients. One, and these don't necessarily happen in order. One is disengagement. Usual events disengage from the context and the identity in which people know themselves, like a divorce, death, job change, a move, an illness. The disengagement begins a process of change. Two, dismantling. Old familiar behaviors and habitual practices are taken apart a piece at a time. This gradual transition involves slowly unpacking the lost relationship, including the lost identity that's part of it. An ending stops what used to be. It's not the old way anymore, but yet not the new way as this dismantling occurs. Three, disidentification. Ending connections with what used to be, you lose an old way of defining yourself. Old friends you didn't inherit in the divorce. Often people describe this phase as not being quite sure who they are. I thought about this kind of loss, this disidentification, a good deal when I came to terms with retiring from my practice of teaching, my practice and teaching of psychiatry and psychoanalysis to become an executive mentor coach a little over a decade ago. For 25 years of practice and 7 years prior to that of medical school residency, I identified with being a doctor. I wondered if using the MD after my name was a way of hanging on to that identity, though I clearly knew I was no longer practicing, nor would I ever return to it. The old identity can potentially stand in the way of transition as well as transformation and self-renewal at times. The trick is to know when and how and if. Four, disenchantment. Coexisting with a still vivid picture of the way things are is the split-screen image of the way things were. Disenchantment is the discovery that in some sense your world is simply no longer the way it used to be. Disenchantment is a recurrent experience throughout the lifetime of anyone who has the courage to trust and believe in the first place and to go through personal transition. Some significant transitions began with disenchantment, the loss of a job, the loss of a relationship. Listen for this possible distinction in your clients. The disenchanted person moves on, while the disillusioned person goes through the play again with new actors, always on a perpetual quest for the elusive, not letting go. Five, disorientation. Disorientation affects a sense of place, space, as well as time. The usual way of structuring time even changes. The future's unclear. These elements, these five elements that we've just talked about of ending, are not in sequence nor any particular order at all. For example, in a divorce, one partner may experience disidentification and disorientation and then decide to act, which leads to disengagement. Now, if you're scoring that play, it's 3-5-1. The other partner, unaware of the impending change, begins an ending with disengagement and the challenge of disenchantment and becomes disoriented. That's 1-4-5. There is no normal or natural order to this sequence, nor is there any normal order of reactions to an ending. It's highly individual. And I'm mentioning this just so you'll be able to understand and to characterize and to help someone navigate through it and make sense of it themselves so that they're developing a new model as you're working with them. Endings are the first rather than the last act of the play. Notice that only the first, disengagement, refers exclusively to external things. The second, dismantling, can be either internal or external, but the last three, disidentification, disenchantment, disorientation, are all internal. It's the internal things that hold us to the past, yet we often try to deal only with the external issues, to leave the relationship, the job, to move across the country. This focus uses change to avoid transition. To storm out of a job because of a bad boss rather than discover what it is that keeps you finding and agreeing to work for the same boss with different faces. To end another relationship rather than letting go of the behaviors, beliefs, and attitudes that keep you choosing the same people and recreating the same relationships. Remember your friend from college who had numerous relationships, yet the dozens of faces were on the same woman or the same man? After someone struggles initially with the change and then begins to grapple with the transition, this is the true work, the beginning of the transformation. This is the second phase, the mid phase, the neutral zone. A resistance to transition is often not the problem of giving up a job or relationship or even of an identity. The real problem is this time of nothingness that awakens old fears about abandonment and death. People in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion. We can expect this as part of a transition. Ending, confusion, new beginning. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar. Now, as a coach, you can reframe this return to the familiar as a way of measuring progress to see how far you've come, or an opportunity to validate your commitment to move forward. This in-between time of transformation is the real work of letting go, and prepares the foundation for the next stage. It's important not to rush through this neutral zone too quickly in order to avoid or minimize the disruption. This is a very important time for a work in progress. When I went through my career transition, I needed a time in between before I began my new career. I knew I was a medical professional in my mind and heart, and I would be tempted to revert to that old identity and style of being when in doubt about my new endeavor, which is why I made a wholesale transition to retire completely from my medical practice and close that out in every way, then to spend some time at my ranch writing and physically working before I began training for certification as a professional coach. In another era, the person in transition left the village and went into a forest or desert to remain for a time. Removed from old connections and without old identities, the old reality changed as well. This in-between time of empty space fostered a generation of a new sense of self. Actually, mine was way closer to the caveman than I realized, including being in a forest for a couple of months. When someone doesn't allow this essential period of time to create a transition, important work is avoided. If transition is treated as an event, like crossing the street, a necessary process is averted. Often someone, without even quite knowing why, finds ways of being alone and away from familiar distractions. Sometimes it's a long weekend alone in a quiet place. Having time to think things over and not do much of anything is the point. One of the significant transitions in work life is an internal one. It's unlikely that someone after the age of 40, let me say that a different way. It's likely after the age of 40 that people transition from being motivated by the chance to demonstrate competence, which they've done before 40, or roughly midlife, to being motivated by the chance to find personal meaning in work and its results. This is the shift from the question of how to the question of why. So competence begins to lose its force as a source of motivation. To do the same thing over and over becomes less challenging, less invigorating. the brain also plays a role in this process. Dopamine is the brain chemical that induces excitement by anticipating pleasure or reward. The rush from dopamine release motivates people to take risks. The risk is exciting, adding to the dopamine release. But neuroscientists have shown that anticipating a reward is even more exciting than actually receiving it. Why is that? Well, because receiving a reward actually shuts down this anticipatory release of dopamine, and along with it, the accompanying positive feelings and high energy, the brain shifts to another system mediated by norepinephrine. This is the chemical system of marathons, not sprints like dopamine. This explains the paradox that the expectation of an event is often more exciting than the actual event. This has been demonstrated in a number of ways. An investor will feel more positive when expecting a stock to rise and yet not feel quite as excited as anticipated when it actually does rise. The purchase of a big ticket item, a new car, isn't as exciting as expected. Clients hit plateaus in coaching after a month or two and consider suspending work. So what we can do in coaching is to foster attitudes that promote curiosity, openness, while introducing new learning, for example, to ladder challenges and successes. And by knowing this phenomenon, we can address it and explain it as a natural development. It's also something that contributes to buyer's remorse, the letdown, the chemical letdown. And you look at, you know, did I really want this? Should I have bought this? It costs too much. And to know this is part of this neurological engine in coaching, I think, is really important. So two questions to focus on the meanings of transition at a particular time in life. One, what is it time to let go of in my life right now? Transition starts with letting go. An important distinction between a change and a transition is that change is focused on reaching a goal, and transitions begin with letting go of what no longer fits the life stage you're in. Each person has to figure out what no longer fits, and it's usually internal rather than external. The transition begins with letting go of something that you've assumed or believed, some way you've always seen yourself, some world outlook or even attitude toward others. Second question, what is waiting to make its entrance into my life? The answer is usually something internal, subjective, often in the shape of an idea or even a question you ask yourself. It may feel like a message to you, a message that something is standing just outside the door of everyday awareness, waiting for your attention. We have to deal with endings all of our lives, yet curiously we often handle them poorly. We either take them too seriously by confusing them with finality, or see them as something without sequel, forgetting that they're simply the first phase of a transition process, a necessary precondition of self-renewal. So at the same time, we fail to take them seriously enough because they scare us, and then we try to avoid them. I saw this in my therapy and analytic practice. It's not the loss of someone that creates problems, but the failure to internalize that person and relationship. For some, their present consists, at least in part, of a past they've not quite let go of. An illustration is the of this emptiness is the neutral zone that Leo Tolstoy talked about. He said it this way, I felt that something had broken within me on which my life had always rested, that I had nothing left to hold on to, that morally my life had stopped, and yet I could give no reasonable meaning to any action of my life. And I was surprised that I had not understood this from the beginning. My state of mind was as if some wicked and stupid jest was being played upon me by someone. I asked myself, what will be the outcome of what I do today, and what shall I do tomorrow? What will be the outcome of my life? Why should I live? Why should I do anything? The reasons for this emptiness between the old life and the new include the process of transformation is essentially a death and rebirth process, not a mechanical modification. The process of disengagement and reintegration is the process of renewal, just the way an apple tree needs the cold of winter. The emptiness between the stages of a life journey provides a perspective on the stages themselves. This in-between time provides access to a view, a perspective, that can occur nowhere else. So here's a summary of some creative use of this neutral zone, this mid-phase. One, embrace setbacks, losses, and disadvantages as entry points into new solutions. Two, establish a regular time and place to be alone, to step back, to take stock, to question the usual, to come up with new and creative solutions. Three, provide opportunities for others important in your change and transition to step back and review as well, even do it with you. Accept your need for this time in the neutral zone. Number four, make sense of your experience of this time as being important so it doesn't feel like a dead-end road. Trying to speed things up disrupts the necessary process that occurs. Remember, it's a process, not an event. Five, engage in training and techniques of discovery and innovation. Become informed about the change in the transition process. You guys are doing it right now, and this will benefit your clients immensely, I hope. What you're doing just now and help your clients do will take an opportunity also to discover more of who you really are and what you really want. Six, engage in experimentation. Try out ideas you wished you'd had the chance to try. After I closed my practice, I considered using my experience as founder and CEO of a couple of healthcare corporations and involvement with a startup with partners that went through venture capital funding to merger and acquisition to really enter the corporate world and become an executive. Now, thankfully, that lasted about 25 seconds. Seven, keep a log of neutral zone experiences, kind of a diary. Eight, take this pause in the action of your life to write an autobiography. Get your story up today. Think of what would be unlived in your life if it ended today. That was the most dramatic question that I asked a group of executives at a retreat that a buddy and I did called What's Next Exec, a group of executive CEOs from all over the country, immensely successful by any metrics. And I said, what is your unlived life? Give me a response within 30 seconds because that guarantees it's going to be from the right lobe, the emotional response. And many said that was the most profound question that they were asked or that they thought about that entire weekend. 10, reflect consciously on the present transition experience in your own life. The neutral zone, the time in between the old life and the new, is a rich time for insight like this. And 3, you finish with a new beginning. A new beginning follows the ending, and the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity. It's when the endings are finished that we can truly begin. The end allows a new beginning. We may not always know when the ending is complete and when we've been in the neutral zone long enough, especially when the path is a genuinely new beginning. For a time, we may not even know what is a real path, but that's okay. Think about the important beginnings in your own past. You bumped into an old friend you hadn't seen for years, and he told you about a job at his company that opened up just that morning. You met your spouse-to-be at a party you really hadn't planned to go to and almost skipped. You picked up a book that changed your life because it was the only thing laying on a friend's coffee table when you dropped by for an unexpected visit. The lesson in these experiences is that when we're ready to make a new beginning, we'll find an opportunity. When you're ready to learn, a teacher will appear. There'll be a wine and cheese event. New beginnings often occur with an internal realignment rather than an external shift. When we're aligned with deep longings, when needs and ideals align with purpose, each step forward will set off an inner warning system. There'll be fear. The brain's error detection mechanism will read that something's wrong. This is not a signal to retreat to old ways of being, though. Never underestimate the change back pressure from the system. Your family, your company, it's their self-statement of reaction to change. An attempt to restore normal order and not do the work of change is simply the way their brains are working, like your brains are working, to avoid something new. a group or a system has a status quo bias and inertia, as well as an individual. Jung, the psychoanalyst, said, the most important problems can't be solved. They have to be outgrown. The important distinction here, I believe, is this. Have you really moved through the endings and the neutral zone to find the beginning you now want to follow? Or is this beginning a way of avoiding an ending and avoiding this neutral zone experience? One thing you can do is to begin to identify yourself with the final result of the new beginning. What's it going to feel like when you've actually done what you're setting out to do? We understandably have ambivalence about new feelings. We have not established a comfort zone, and this is to a couple of the questions some of you have asked, not grooved a default mode in our minds and brains. We don't know the outcome, so it's attendant with anxiety. So beginnings may reactivate old anxieties as well as making it very real that the ending has happened. The risk and uncertainty of the new beginning will resonate also with past anxiety, perhaps even trigger old memories of failures, and the new beginning will erode the equilibrium of the neutral zone. For example, one of the most challenging aspects of truly being an adult and taking care of ourselves is that we have to come to the end of the past, the hope that someone else will do it for us. And it's more difficult to let go of what never was, even though what was traumatically so, because you then have to give up hope of ever having it in exactly the way you wanted it, and with it the illusion that there's an ultimate arbiter of fairness. New beginnings need to have a clear sense of purpose. To reinforce a new beginning, you'll have to evolve a new identity that replaces the old one. In beginning, take things step by step. Recognize the assumptions and resist the temptation that some other route would go more smoothly and events would always be easier or exciting and meaningful. It's like comparing yourself with someone else. You're comparing your inside with their outside. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison. It's important in a new beginning not to be preoccupied with results. For example, rather than each interview that does not produce a job seeming like a failure and everything that happened being a mistake, reframe the process as an activity in which each interview teaches something, creates a new context and contact, and deepens an understanding of the process and of oneself. This is a really important aspect of a new beginning, to shift your purpose from the goal to the process of reaching the goal. For example, the new job is to find a new job. Every transition is a transition from something into something. Each of these transitions corresponds to internal changes, an integration of a new identity with elements of the old one. There are many endings, many little beginnings, with emptiness and creation in between. There are very few times that we actually have direct contact with our future selves. We seldom review our present circumstances as they might appear to a relatively objective future self. When we plan ahead, we specify goals rather than future development of identity or states of mind. This may contribute to looking back at our own past with a bit of alienation or disbelief, almost as if someone else lived it. Exceptions occur at certain moments in life, perhaps prompted by the excitement of a major event, that we look ahead in time and think, I'll remember this moment forever. This awareness seems to change present experience, to enhance it with a special lighting and sharp focus. Here are some considerations, and I want to close with this and then a question and a challenge. Some considerations to reinforce the new beginning. One, be consistent. This is the best way to get an idea of how something will work. To be consistent, be totally immersed in the process. Secondly, shrink the change to ensure stepwise successes, one step at a time. The experience then of effectiveness with each step. Three, evolve a new identity. Generate a symbol of this identity, a representation that can be a consistent point of a reference. And four, celebrate small successes. In 10 or 20 years, when we look back on present time, laced among experiences will inevitably be some envy and regret. We envy the younger self who could relatively do so much and will regret that younger self did not do more or different or better. We may wonder why we loved too little, learned too much, are too little, risk too low, spent too much time in routine and distraction. This view from a future self looking back to the present can be very informative. So, here's a question and a challenge. The question: imagine a photograph of you 100 years from now. What is the story you most want your grandchildren to tell about you? And here's the challenge. What if right now is a turning point for you? The time your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now. The time you awakened your deep passion and acted on it. The time you did what you were always meant to do. Or this moment of truth may be a brief awakening, silenced by the sensible obstacles we're familiar with constructing. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content telling stories about your favorite sports team or what great cookies you used to bake. It will all depend on how brave you'll be. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. We have a few minutes, not as much as I'd hoped, for questions and discussion. I'm interested in your thoughts and your questions and your take on this. I know it's hard to suddenly switch from passive listening to active discussion, but thoughts or questions? Okay, that's a good sigh of transition. And then
hi,
she
Gary.
Said...
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, hi. This is Kathy in Toronto.
Great, thanks.
Hi. I had a bit of an aha moment when you were talking about how even small endings have their own personality, and you were comparing sort of everyday things, endings like the guy leaving the party early, with the bigger changes and so on. I thought that was a really, really interesting insight because I'd never really thought of that before.
Hmm.
You know, the patterns that you have in dealing with endings.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I mean, I just was just really, I'm going to have to go back over it and just sort of think about that because it's just like the patterns and the connections between everything, right? We often sort of get,
exactly.
I think, caught up in the big story, the big drama, the big motion picture or whatever, but it's the little bits day to day that are often more telling.
Yes, we're writing our own story, and the story tells most about the teller. And mm-hmm. in another way of saying what you did, whatever we think and feel and experience are what we create at each moment. And a way of really looking at and understanding about our clients is to look at understanding their stories and to deconstruct their stories to learn to have our clients recognize and own their stories, then to assess them, to decide what components to change, and then look at authoring those changes. There are, and I'll send you an addendum to what you have. It's a process that I call the roadmap system. Seven steps to deconstruct a story to understand. Could I get a mute on the breathing noise? You probably aren't hearing it, but there's some breath noises. If you'll mute if you're not talking, it'll help our focus here. I'll send you an overview of the roadmap system of understanding and constructing, understanding and deconstructing the writing of a story and how to think about constructing a new one. And it's some of the Live New Life Story, the curriculum for New Money Story Wellness Training and New Money Story Mentor Training. So I'll send you kind of an overview, and it'll give you an idea of some components of a story writing, because our stories are consistent, whether they're, as you said, Kathy, the little endings or the big, huge ending. It's the same story writer, and we're using the same process to write that story. So that's how it's so important for us as coaches to learn to listen to that story, to listen to, and this is an equation I think you'll find useful, beliefs drive behavior, and and behavior drives performance. So the beliefs are the mind's command to the brain, the software that we operate on that then determine what our behavior is and our performance. So we ultimately come to look at the beliefs that aren't working to tweak them and the ones that are working to enhance them even more. So if you have other questions or other thoughts, I'm very interested. Jot them down. We'll begin here next time. When you take a look at the email, I'm interested in your responses to those two questions about what you'd really like to be sure we cover and what you'd like to walk away with. I appreciate your responses and will appreciate those of you that do respond. So thanks very much, and I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Bye now. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.